Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. This week we're taking a look at Hillbilly Elegy, the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, Lovers Rock, You Cannot Kill David Arquette, and Collective. But before we get to those, we need to talk about this week's delights on The Mandalorian that featured Squid Head and Boba Fett lookalike. That's the terminology I'm using. What was going on this week? What have we missed?
He makes it to a sort of watery planet this time. I think we can only refer to them as we used to call them, squid heads. There's now seems to be quite a lot of squid heads wandering around. He's on this mission looking for his own kind, isn't he? And and find some of them this time as well, which I think is going to take us off into another direction further on. But it's more of Baby Yoda being super cute, basically, which is what we all want.
Yes, and when we get to the Lego Star Wars movie later, even they acknowledge that you've got to shove a cute bit of Baby Yoda in there for everybody's pleasure. Is it still the quality and the excitement it was at the beginning, Matthew Leyland, you Star Wars nerd, you? Are you still enjoying it as much?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's kind of, the story's turning into a bit of a tease. They're kind of stretching some things out. I mean, essentially, everybody's waiting for the debut of Ahsoka Tano, apparently played by Rosario Dawson, which isn't even official yet, but it seems highly likely. And we at least got to hear her name this week, so we know that she's coming. She's a big deal in the Star Wars universe. But we did get another new character, Bo-Katan, who's another Mandalorian, played by Katie Sackhoff, who previously voiced the character in the Clone Wars and Rebels series, but is now playing in live action, which is a fairly rare event, I would think, someone going from voicing a character to actually embodying them in a live action.
It goes the other way, doesn't it? I mean, you do play a character in a film and then you might play the voice in a, you know, animated series or in a video game or something, but it's unusual to go this way around.
Yeah, do that. And she was terrific. I mean, she knows that character really well. There's lots of great action. I thought it had a really nice balance, this last episode of violence and cuteness. I mean, there were some really adorable, you know, cockle-warming moments with the child, but also some terrific action as well. Lots of rocket packs and grenades and shootouts and near misses and crashes. So it was a pretty satisfying episode altogether.
Is that the criteria we're going for this week? The nice balance of violence and cuteness.
Violence and cuteness.
In it as well. When they're in the sort of, well, restaurant, I suppose you'd call it, for want of a better word, and Baby Yoda has sort of a nice bowl of clam chowder served out from a sort of pipe, which I can't really like the detail. I'm not sure if health and safety would approve that, but that's the beauty of the show. It's just got such wonderful levels of detail in the Star Wars universe that you've never seen before, but makes complete sense.
Feels very much of the world. Well, we've got next week's episode to look forward to, but shall we take a look at what we have to look at this week on streaming? Let's start with this.
I told you that I would do better.
You always say that. You're lying.
I always try.
You got to think about these kids.
What do you think I've been thinking about since I was 18 years old, huh? Never had a life where I wasn't thinking about the kids.
Do you actually want to be dead, Mom? Or are you just too lazy to try?
Jamie. Oh, I tried. Plenty.
You've always got a reason. It's always someone else's fault. Some point, you're going to have to take responsibility. Or someone else is going to have to step in.
Who, huh? You?
Okay, so that's Hillbilly Elegy, which hits Netflix tomorrow. James, what is this about?
Well, it's based on the 2016 memoir by J.D. Vance, who came from a sort of small town Ohio background. His mother, Bev, was kind of a loose cannon, basically became a heroin addict, and it's really his story of how he survived that pretty tough upbringing and ultimately got to Yale Law School, which is kind of an incredible journey that he takes. And the film sort of flip-flops between his time at Yale, where he's dating a woman called Usha, played by Frida Pinto. Vance, at this stage, is played by Gabriel Basso. And it sort of flips back also to his teenage years, where his mother, Bev, is played by Amy Adams. His grandmother, Mormor, I think you pronounce it, is Glenn Close.
Mormor. Don't do it with a southern accent there. Mormor.
Yeah. And he's sort of flipping between the two as he's heading back from Yale. He's sort of on this kind of emergency dash, really. kind of like a character story, a life story of this incredible journey that he's been through.
Yeah, the book made quite a splash when it came out, because it obviously came out around the time that sort of Trump was voted into office. And it was quite a sort of study of poor white class and the people who may have contributed to him winning that election. So it was more of a sort of socio-economic study of a society in America sort of wrapped up in this family history. The film doesn't do that, does it? It sort of jettisons the social commentary in favor of the sort of story of a American dream, I suppose, of a boy pulling himself up by his bootstraps and escaping this sort of quite bleak background in a town where the industry's dried up and there's not much money and the opiate crisis is in free fall. Does that work? Did you like it? Did it grab you?
I did like it. I didn't love it, but we should add probably at this stage it's a Ron Howard film, yes, which is probably indicates everything you just said as to why he's gone for the more wholesome approach. I think there's some fantastic performances in it, first of all. I mean, Amy Adams and Glenn Close primarily. And I liked it for that reason, just to watch those guys go full flow. I mean, Glenn in her kitty and puppy t-shirts. I mean, what more do you want than that?
I mean, she's kind of unrecognizable, isn't she, with this curly perm, huge, like sort of massive glasses, oversized t-shirts with, as you say, sort of puppies and kittens on them and floral leggings. And she just is fearsome, shouting at everyone. I mean, every single time she comes on screen, every speech she does is like a clip from the Oscar reel, isn't it? It's like pure Oscar bait.
Yeah.
But is it worthy of an Oscar, Matthew?
I don't think it'll be in with much of a chance aside from Glenn Close. I mean, I think she's pretty much nailed on for at least a nomination for supporting actress, maybe Amy Adams as well. I liked it to start with. There's a good hour in there. I was enjoying it. I was engaged with them. You know, it's lots of energy. Like you say, I mean, every scene is like an Oscar clip. There's so many big confrontations, big emotions in every scene. But just the further it went on, I really struggled to see, you know, what was kind of really special about these characters. I don't think they really sold what was so special about JD's journey in a way. I mean, I think that's really a failing of the direction and the screenplay. And I also found the chronology quite irritating, the way it flip-flops between past and present. I felt like it really stuttered the momentum every time it did that. I would much rather it had just gone in a linear fashion. So I found that quite frustrating.
Something that it started with JD at college and then flashback and then returned to him. Yeah.
And then you've got Frida Pinto as JD's girlfriend.
Thankless role.
Yeah, utterly thankless. She's just on the phone half the time just saying, oh, don't worry.
Telling him which knife to use at dinner.
Yeah. You've got Hayley Bennett as well as the sister Lindsay, and that's thankless role number two.
It's also really weird. Hayley plays the same character as a girl and as a woman. You're like, how old is she at any given time that she comes on screen? Couldn't pinpoint it because she was the same, whereas the boy they had was a man and a boy in these different flashbacks and present day. So it's just very tricky to work out with Hayley where we were in the time frame. But yeah, I agree with you. I think this is extremely well done, you know, handsomely filmed. There's nothing particularly wrong with it, but there's nothing very exciting or desperate or wonderful about it either. It's just fine. I think Glenn will get nominations all over the shop because it's just scene chewing marvelousness, isn't it? And at the end, you do get the real life home videos of the family, and you can see how close she was to being Mormor. That's exactly what she looked like. I don't think anyone will watch it, and it will live long in their mind or imagination after they finish.
No.
You know, I felt like everything was there. And it's just as Matthew said, the structure is quite frustrating and they didn't quite get the pieces right, basically. That's sort of how it ultimately felt.
And it's also a bit frustrating to see Amy Adams do this role because I feel like she'd done it with more nuance and finesse in Sharp Objects.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this damaged woman who lives in this particular society trying desperately to get out of a sort of vicious circle and not succeeding. I've seen her do it and do it really well before. So I felt like I didn't really know why she took this on, unless she just wanted to get in scenes with Glenn Close shouting her head off and barging around the kitchen with multiple cigarettes in her mouth.
Could be.
It's sort of a bit of a mystery as to what she was getting out of it as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So are we recommending this to people? I mean, it's a bit of class to watch this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you like the actors and if you want to kind of get an early steer on what the awards race might look like, then yeah, I'd say give it a chance. Certainly, yeah. I think it works better on the small screen than it would have done on the big screen.
Yeah, it just does feel almost perfectly suited to a Netflix film than, yeah, a possible big screen outing.
Maybe it would have worked better had it been a four-part series or something, and there wasn't more time to spend with these people. Anyway, have a look yourself. That's Hillbilly Elegy, which hits Netflix tomorrow. So, should we go from one dysfunctional family to another then? Let's get Christmas jumpers ready for this.
'Twas the night before Life Day, in a galaxy far, far away.
Looking good. Tree, food, decorations.
Coming together, heroes were, to celebrate the day.
Please be a cape. Please be a cape.
It's a wrap!
For Rey, adventure called, and she thought it would be fast.
Wow.
But there she found a key to the galaxy's past.
What are you doing?
So this is the Lego Star Wars holiday special. We've had a holiday special from Star Wars before, haven't we, Matthew?
We have, yes. A long time ago, in 1978, it was the notorious Star Wars holiday special. Yes.
Much derided.
For
all of its sing-song glory.
Which George Lucas later disowned.
This is your chance, then, to watch a holiday special in the Star Wars universe. Also in the Lego universe, what have they done with the whole Star Wars world and Lego? How have they created a story, Matthew?
Well, they've retained one of the key aspects of the original holiday special, which is Life Day, which is basically Wookiee Christmas. So it kind of, again, centers on that. But there's another big plot this time, and it takes place straight after Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. And Rey is attempting to train Finn, who, as we kind of learned in the film, is now force sensitive. So she's giving him some Jedi training. It's not going too well. So she goes to a temple, perhaps seeking help, seeking some clues. And she finds a time key. This time key is essentially a MacGuffin, and it sends her on all sorts of travels through every single trilogy, every film in the Star Wars universe and The Mandalorian, meeting different incarnations of classic characters. So she meets older Luke, younger Luke, multiple Hans, multiple Obi-Wans, and it's really an excuse for just lots of skits, lots of silliness, lots of different characters meeting each other who might not usually meet, a few battles, and at the center of it always Life Day as well. You get all the Wookiees getting ready to eat lots of turkey and celebrate. So it's very silly, kind of throwaway, but very enjoyable, especially, you know, for the diehard Star Wars fans.
It's not sort of very po-faced, is it? It's very happy to take the piss out of Star Wars as well.
Very irreverent,
As you would come to expect from a Lego movie. Did you enjoy it, James? Did you get a laugh out of
it? I saw it a few days ago now, and I'm struggling slightly to remember it, because as Matthew said, it is very throwaway. It did make me laugh at the time, though. I mean, there's a moment, I think, where Kylo Ren sees the Emperor, and he's kind of like, oh, how did that happen? Which is a complete kind of mocking of the fact that, you know, the Emperor has turned up in Rise of Skywalker 30 years later.
Yes, there's lots of jokes about that, isn't there? Like, throw him into the reactor because he'll never come back from that.
It is, as you say, it's not po-faced. It does mock the sort of pomposity slightly of some of these films. I mean, Max Rebo turns up, which was very, very pleasing for Return of the Jedi fans out there, for example. I mean, there's loads of great little characters that turn up. I think I'm a big fan of the Lego Star Wars video game, which I played. I was a little disappointed to see there weren't characters building blocks of things like they do in the game, you know, and actually a bit more Lego stuff. But, you know, that would have been nice. Just I think there was a table that breaks early on, and I thought, oh, well, one of them could repair the table very quickly like they do in the game, you know, sort of a little hands flurrying and, you know, building.
That would have been nice.
It would have been nice. But aside from that, I thought it was a lot of fun.
There's some really good voice work as well. Yeah. You have Helen Sadler playing Rey, and she sounds exactly like Daisy Ridley.
Yeah.
You know, I really think it was Daisy Ridley all the way through until I saw the credits. So she does this uncanny impersonation. And there's also Trevor Duvall, the voice actor, playing the Emperor. And he really steals the show. I mean, he has such fun saying, you know, saying shooty shooty and all these other little catchphrases.
Less talky talky, more fighty fighty. I mean, frankly, the bad guys in this get all the best lines, don't they?
Yes,
I mean, there's just some really fun bits with Darth Vader and Kylo Ren and the Emperor all trying to sort of be the best bad guy. And then this joke about, you know, Darth Vader really trying to give the Emperor a nice life day present and him not being happy with the mug he's brought him. And then things like, you know, just jokes about his chair spins both ways and how amazing that is. There's a lot of detail and silliness in there that I think probably if you watched it a couple of times, you'd enjoy even more with all the detail in it. I really had a laugh with it. It's definitely something that I'd watch now, but also I'll pop on at Christmas because it's 48 minutes long. It doesn't take a lot. And it's something you could definitely watch when you're full of turkey and having a little glass of wine and have a giggle about all of the silly things that are going on. And as we say, you know, Baby Yoda does make an appearance in the middle of a fight. Yeah. Delightful, delightful. Who doesn't want him in just Star Wars content? I would totally recommend this. I don't know about you guys.
Yes, of course.
Yep, definitely.
It's a winner. Okay, so if you want to get your Lego Star Wars on, you do need to wear a holiday sweater, I think. Even Darth Vader does. It's on Disney Plus from tomorrow. Shall we get back onto this planet, back to planet Earth, with this? Okay, so this is Lover's Rock, which is the second film in Steve McQueen's anthology of small acts. We obviously saw Mangrove last week. What's this one about this week, James?
Lover's Rock is set in, again, sort of an early 1980s sort of West London. It's very, very different to Mangrove, I'll say that much. It's a kind of house party story, really, and quite slight on some level. The main character, Martha, who's played by Amara J. Santoban, I hope I pronounced that correctly. She basically sneaks out of her house, heads to a house party, meets a guy played by Michael Ward, who was in Blue Story. And, you know, there's some dancing, there's some kissing, there's some chat. It kind of unfolds from there. It's a very sort of casually made film on some level compared to Mangrove. Very, very different. At the end, it's dedicated to all the lovers and rockers, which I quite liked as a nice sort of little sign-off. Anyone who loves reggae, it's absolutely perfect. It really captures that sound, captures that early 1980s vibe without ever overblowing it. Yeah, really quite beautiful, short, punchy piece of work. It's only 70 minutes long.
Yeah, a real mood piece. What did you think of it, Matthew?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's so immersive. It's kind of a shame in a way that it is being released on TV because I'd love to have seen this on a big screen, you know, with proper Dolby stereo sound. But I mean, even just watching, you know, on a laptop, you really feel like you're at this party. I mean, you kind of get the sounds, the smells. It just feels so authentic. Just the scenes where people are dancing are just fantastic. I mean, I don't know. He must have worn out his cast doing that. I mean, you have these long takes of them just dancing and dancing. And there's one particularly extraordinary bit with the song Silly Games, where they dance along to it and then they sing it a cappella as well, the whole cast effectively. It's just such a joyful, uplifting moment. It really is terrific. And such a contrast to Mangrove as well.
Yes, that was hard work, Mangrove. And tough. This feels very sort of light and joyous and sort of life-affirming and come join the party in comparison, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost necessary after Mangrove. I don't know what the next episode will entail,
it's
but
red, white,
I don't think you
blue.
Could put a really harsh episode after Mangrove. The ordering, let's say, was exactly right with this one.
I mean, you get an aspect of that party atmosphere in Mangrove when people are spilling out of the Mangrove restaurant and dancing in the street and passing drinks around. But this is just a whole immersive 78 minutes of that. And probably, would we suggest that people don't watch it on an empty stomach?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
There's some great food being cooked up in the kitchen, isn't there?
Yeah, lots of food, lots of drink. There's one particularly funny moment where a guy puts his beer down and then in a split second, someone else picks it up without him noticing it. And the choreography of that is just so funny. He really carries it off really well. It's just this kind of light throwaway moment. Things like that really added to it for me. And the very final scene is very funny as well.
And it's also sort of
tension in the thing as well, though. I mean, although it is joyous, elements are happening in the background where you're never quite sure where this party could go. You know, is is something bad going to happen? I'm obviously not going to say what, but yeah, it's just in the background, you feel that sort of possible tension that clearly has been explored a great deal more in Mangrove, but here it just simmers away, it feels like.
Yeah.
Like one of those pots on the stove. It's also kind of nice, I suppose, to watch a party like this with loads of people crammed in a house when we're all not crammed in a house. Is this a way to get your fix of sort of non-social distancing? Do you think it's something nice to watch when we're all on our own in our houses, social distancing?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's set in the 1980s, but I mean, you know, it kind of makes you nostalgic for 2019 when you could do things like that. So, yeah, who'd have thought, you know, but yeah, it does feel quite unusual to see lots of people pressed together in one room, you know, and it being allowed. So, yeah, it does have that aspect.
Well, so that is Lovers Rock, which is on BBC One this Sunday and also available on iPlayer. Okay, so shall we change it completely and go for something completely bonkers? Let's take a look at this.
Why do you want to get back in the ring?
It's been 18 years of people thinking I disrespected wrestling.
I'm just kind of sick of being a joke.
There's a lot going on with David.
His anxiety is crippling.
2 years ago, it's a heart attack. A year later, it's a death match. So what does that mean for next year?
If the ribs actually break, they can actually bleed into your lung.
Wrestling's not fake, guys. Wrestling's not fake.
So that's You Cannot Kill David Arquette. What is David Arquette doing in this documentary? And it feels a bit like you maybe can kill David Arquette if you try hard enough.
Yeah, this is literally the craziest film I've seen in a long time. I had absolutely no idea what it was about. I think I'd read an article recently where he was interviewed, but I hadn't read much about the film. It goes back to 2000, where he was in a film called Ready to Rumble, and he got involved in wrestling. This is now set, you know, 18 or so years later, and he's still pursuing the wrestling dream. I mean, early on, you see him in a car saying he hasn't got a role for about 10 years. He's pursuing this wrestling instead, and he's doing it for real. He's going to all these kind of backwater wrestling rings, sustaining horrible injuries. He looks like he has a lovely wife, lovely kids, lovely house, you know, normal-looking life, and yet he's doing this absolute craziness kind of, you know, on the side. It's one of the most bizarre celebrity films I've seen in a long time. It reminded me of the mock documentary I'm Still Here with Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was a mock-up. This was for real.
But was it, though? That was the question I kept asking. How much of this is real and how much is a sort of extended reality-based theatrics? Because this is wrestling, and you know, the wrestling people that are on the documentary do discuss the fact that, you know, wrestling is a sport, but a theatrical sport. And so I wondered if that was a clue for us to take what was happening on screen as a heightened version of what David Arquette was actually going through. I mean, it does seem like it is real. But it, as you say, it is nuts, the stuff he does. When he goes to this sort of peanut butter falcon type wrestling ring in the backyard of these guys, there is just this stage that they've created that's so rubbish they haven't actually, you know, locked it together and it breaks halfway through. They load it with tacks and throw him on it. They're smashing stuff on him. He's horribly injured. And there's a horrific moment later on in the documentary where he goes to a death match and frankly, I don't want to say what happens, but flipping heck, it's hard to watch and believe that somebody's doing that. As you say, James, I found it one of the most entertaining films I've seen in a long time. Did you like it, Matthew?
Yeah, I did. I mean, there's never a dull moment, but I was a bit distracted by the whole, is it a hoax? Is it real? You know, is he genuine? Is he trying to just claw back some spotlight? I really liked all the other interviewees. Like, you could briefly get to see his famous sisters, Patricia and Rosanna, and his ex-wife, Courtney Cox. And I would have kind of liked a lot more of them, really. I would have liked a kind of broader portrait of the Arquette family, because they are kind of fascinating. You know, they have this acting dynasty. I mean, they've all been famous. They're all well-known. So I would have liked a bit more insight into that instead of more of his kind of silly hijinks. But it's kind of car crash viewing. You keep watching just to see what lunacy is going to come next.
Yeah,
there's a bit at the end where his wife says, what is the point of all this? And I did kind of share that sentiment, I have to admit.
It's his second wife. And she says at one point, you know, I don't just have kids. I have like another kid. David's my other kid. And it does feel like that. He sits on these giant chairs in his garden saying, I don't want to grow up. He's sort of like this Peter Pan figure who has storage facilities full of dressing up clothes and puppets that he plays with. He's a very interesting character, you know, and he has this neurological condition that he goes to the doctors to have ketamine for. His brain doesn't function right, they say. It's not firing on all cylinders. He sort of is this very, very interesting person. And what drives him, there's this sort of thing of, as you mentioned, James, he was crowned the king of wrestling and got the belt, but that was deemed an absolute catastrophe in the sport because he didn't earn it. He was a Hollywood actor who came in and talked the talk, but didn't walk the walk. So he feels like he has to sort of amend for this atrocity in the sport 18 years ago. And it's sort of this weird redemption movie, like The Wrestler. And also that he's sort of trying to bring kudos for the sport as well. You know, he's trying to show that it's not just fake. It's not just people pretending to roundhouse kick each other. You really are going to get a black eye. You really are going to get cut. You really are going to get a slip disc or a busted nose. And the time people put in it and the sort of injuries they get is all very real and take it very seriously. And there's a Trump cameo in it.
Like, of course, yeah.
It's astonishing what things Trump has been up to. He rolls around and wrestles a contestant to the floor at one point. So yeah, everything is fascinating to me.
I never thought of it as a hoax at all. That's because how gullible I am. I mean, I completely fell for the Joaquin Phoenix documentary. I thought it was completely real until, of course, it was completely revealed that it wasn't. So I went into this, well, as I said, knowing nothing about it. But as soon as I started watching it, I just assumed it's all completely true. Now, that just shows what a sucker I am, possibly.
I'm not saying it isn't. I just really couldn't tell where the sort of line was, or if there was one.
Well, yeah, how much of it's stage managed, how much he's really going through this crisis, or whether he's just kind of doing it for a laugh, or, you know, just as an interesting role to get back into the movie.
And, you know, he says, oh, I haven't had a job for 10 years. And it's like, I was like, well, that's not true. You know, that's actually not true. We reviewed him in Spree only a few months ago. So,
of course,
so then
you've forgotten that one, really.
So then, you know, like, I'm sort of like, if we take that as not necessarily true, do we then take everything he says as not necessarily true? And of course, you know, we're getting these talking heads from his sisters, as you mentioned, who are both actresses. You know, they're very good at portraying something if they want to. So I just really didn't, I even didn't know, like, did they really live in a commune as children? All of it. I was like, I don't know, but I'm loving the fact that I don't know. That's a bit of a treat, isn't it? Watching a film where you don't know where it's going to go and what's happening. Because we do watch quite a lot of films that are very predictable, and this really wasn't.
It's not.
It portrays the wrestling community quite well as well. I mean, all, you know, it has sort of clips with fans and things, and they do seem genuine. Those kind of guys love this sport.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, in the end, I suppose it's about whether Arquette's embraced by the community or not, and that's part of the journey of the film. And I like that side of things. You know, they weren't mocking those fans or mocking the sport. I think there was a genuine love for the sport in there.
Yeah. And you know, who knew that they do street wrestling in Mexico? When you pull up at the traffic lights, a man will smash another man over the head with a chair.
That's extraordinary.
It was an extraordinary revelation.
Anything like it.
Yeah. So I think it's well worth anybody's time. And actually, it's one of those films that, had we all been going to the cinema, might have slipped through the cracks. And I think the fact that we are all watching films on streaming, this one is one you should definitely make time for. And hopefully it gets an audience that it should.
Definitely.
So that is You Cannot Kill David Arquette, which is available on digital download from Monday the 23rd of November. So shall we move on to another documentary? Not as much clowning or smashing chairs around heads in this one. Let's get ready for this.
Am avut o încredere o arbă în autorități.
Iar ce vedem aici, de când am venit, e... Dar tot ce e sub este puteț.
Okay, so that's The Collective. What is The Collective and what is this documentary focused on?
This is a Romanian documentary. The starting point is a nightclub fire that happened in Bucharest in 2015, which we see some truly horrific footage of. But then it kind of goes from there and starts to investigate why so many of the survivors of this fire, who were hospitalized, why so many of them died subsequently. unusually, it's a sports paper that gets this scoop on what's been going on, and it's essentially to do with standards of hospitalization, that we discover that detergent that's been used in the hospital has been diluted, watered down several times, so there's all kinds of bacteria going around this hospital, and that's what's been causing the deaths and these quite horrific conditions. And we kind of follow the progress of both the paper with its investigation, and also there's a new health minister in Romania as well who's intent on reforming this clearly corrupt, very damaged system. But we see him coming up against obstacle after obstacle, you know, kind of ongoing. He's trying his best to get these reforms sorted and get to the truth of the matter, but he comes up against all these bureaucratic obstacles all the way through. So I mean, it's quite grim, depressing viewing, but at the same time it is a very, very well made film. It's kind of similar in some ways to Spotlight from a few years ago. You know, it's very kind of straightforward. There's no music, there's a few captions, but there's no voiceover. It just kind of observes. It's because, you know, they get this amazing access to everybody, so you really do feel like you're part of this investigation, and it's very lucid all the way through. But yes, very grim viewing, I would say.
I mean, it's hard to say whether you enjoyed it. But did you enjoy it? Did you think it's something that was an important film? I mean, obviously, it's covering things that are of interest to everyone globally right now in terms of healthcare and the importance of the media to be able to investigate, criticize, and to hold up the government to accountability, which are all themes that we can all relate to. Is it something that that we should be watching?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it feels very relevant. And the story is told in very, you know, very clear, precise terms as well. You're in no doubt of what's happening all the time. It's by no means an easy watch, but it is kind of very grimly compelling.
There's the inclusion as well of the girl, one of the sort of, I suppose, victims of the fire, who's very much not a victim, really, I felt watching it. I mean, she's been badly burnt. She'd lost a hand through this fire. And yet you see her sort of photographed in sort of various kind of almost art gallery style portrayal in a way. It's quite interesting, and it's showing another side of this horrifying, well, first of all, the horrifying fire, and then, you know, she was clearly a survivor, she's someone who's made it through this horrifying corruption that's existed in this system as well. And I suppose there is some hope, is what I'm trying to say, through her portrayal. I mean, it's a very fly-on-the-wall documentary. It's very observational. You're never really told what to think here. You're presented with, first of all, the reporter, as you mentioned, Matthew, the health minister later on, and then Teddy, who's the survivor. Her story's woven throughout. So there is this, however grim it is, there is sort of this level of hope that floats through the story as well.
Yeah, she's quite an inspiring figure, isn't she, against all this corruption and greed and cover-up and lying. So, yeah, at least you do have her to kind of cling on to.
And Collective is the name of the club that went up in flames, but this is also, Collective is obviously, the meaning of Collective is to work together, and that seems to be the message of the film as well. Do you think this is a film?
I'm not sure if anyone's actually working. I mean, certainly the reporters are working together, but yeah, then you look at it and you look at these government ministers that are sort of trotting out barefaced lies at press conferences.
Well, gosh, that never happens anywhere else. Doesn't it?
Well,
I know. I was shocked by it. I told you I'm gullible. You know, I believe everything they said. But it's shocking when you just realise the level of corruption here.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just one hospital. It was sort of nationwide, and everyone was getting kickbacks. It is a remarkable piece of filmmaking that, you know, clearly he's not made this over a couple of months. This has spanned a long
dense
time.
It's dense,
investigation and, incredibly patient piece of work.
And do we think that this is something that will be in the running for Best Documentary when the award season rolls around?
Well, it's Romania's entry for Best International Film. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's got a good chance. I'd love to see it on the shortlist when that emerges next year, because, it would be great to get as many people as possible to watch this film. It's very eye-opening.
Yeah, and it's a film that sort of really asks audiences to challenge what they're being told and always sort of ask the hard questions. Okay, so we would highly recommend that. That is The Collective, which is available on digital platforms from Friday the 20th of November. So that's all we've got time for this week. But before we go, we do have a reader's question. While we're in the midst of lockdown 2, we're all dreaming about travel. So this question is, where's the most exotic place you've been for work? Where have you been sent for your job? James, we send you all over the place. You've been to so many exotic locales. Tell us where you've been.
I was trying to think about this. I'd say, well, it is for a film that's coming up, so something to look forward to. For Jungle Cruise, I went to Hawaii for that, to watch that
being shot,
which was, reasonably exotic, I thought.
Very exotic. What are you talking about?
Yes, very long journey to get there and get back. I remember that much. But no, it was a beautiful place to go. It looks like a lot of fun, that film. So we're going to talk about that in the future.
Hawaii. Whenever they may release it.
Yes.
What about you, Matthew? Where has your work taken you?
Well, the furthest flung place I've been to is Middle Earth, Wellington in New Zealand for the set visit to The Hobbit. That was an unexpected journey. I think I was asked to do it just a week before. And so, yeah, I grabbed that chance to go. A long, long time to get there, but that was fantastic. I mean, it was so enjoyable.
And exotic in terms of when you get there as well, like hobbits.
Goodness, yeah.
Going to a whole other realm.
Yeah, and we saw a lot of the locations where they filmed the original Lord of the Rings. It's just incredibly beautiful. And there was all kind of strange bird noises I'd never heard before. I kind of remember being struck by that as soon as I got there. So it did feel like a real kind of long, long journey. Yeah, it was only 3 days, but I'll remember every minute of it, I think.
Yes, that is the part of the job that is absolutely amazing, isn't it? When you get sent somewhere that you never would have thought you'd go. One of my exotics was going to Istanbul to watch Skyfall being filmed and watch Daniel Craig ride his motorcycle on the roof of the Grand Bazaar. When I had a break in filming, I just went off and did a tour of Hagia Sophia, which felt very exotic as well, that was the thing I did. So yeah, we do get to go to a lot of places, but often it's going to a warehouse in Wembley or going to LA and going on a back lot. So it's not always the most exotic locations. And those exotic locations are often made by the magic of movie making. But nevertheless, we're very grateful and we're missing that travel. Let's hope we can be on sets again soon. We actually have our first virtual set coming up tomorrow where we'll be looking at people working on set via our laptop. Let's hope that
new normal.
Yeah, the new normal. Okay, cool. All right, so we should mention that our current issue is out with Mank on the front cover. Woohoo! And it's amazing. And it's got a magazine with it that has a celebration of the golden era of Hollywood. So please do pop out and get that if you can. But in the meantime, we will sign off and say goodbye. And we'll be back next week with more things you can watch on your laptop and your telly. So say goodbye, boys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.